48 hours out from the start of the spring meet. And they drew the Friday card yesterday. Today they'll draw the Bluegrass card and more. And, of course, not just the Bluegrass card, around the game, around the country. New York, Wood Memorial Day, as we discussed, if you were listening to Andy in the last hour. And at Santa Anita. Santa Anita Derby card. there'll be plenty of work to be done starting tonight. Figure those PPs will start registering, start to populate by about, 5 o'clock, 5:30. Certainly by 7, they'll be there, and then we'll start to look for figures, including Thorograph. In fact, tomorrow's Thursday, so Jeff Franklin tomorrow, and Jeff and I will probably pick one race each, and there'll be no shortage of races to choose from with the kind of things that we're going to be confronted with between Bluegrass Day, Santa Anita Derby Day, and Wood Memorial Day. Good morning, Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964. If you're listening to Sirius XM online and on our website, stevebick.com. And alone this morning. And there is another, orientation group that and tour groups that will come through. But we'll be reaching out for the guests this morning, including the Wednesday regulars. Dick Powell will join us, and Dick had a difficult evening, and his wife, I think, with a hospital visit. So I appreciate Dick being able to join us here shortly. We'll do some Valley Where It's Happy, HKJC, but Dick can also contribute plenty to the discussion from yesterday, which is continuing to resonate off of last week's article, Ollie Rader and the Financial Times piece that brought out a number of voices from the game regarding AI and CAW. You've heard, of course, from Scotty McKeever, not about this topic and Scotty's involvement in the piece, but just we're in the shadow really of NHC and the nice period of time again this year that Scotty afforded us utilizing Equine Edge, which feels like a tool for the small player to compete to a degree, at least on the handicapping side, with the groups. And there are some other tools that we'll try to flesh out and continue to to discuss some of the batch, at least the small batch wagering that can be done on likely the ADW that you're utilizing. There's some other tools. In fact, we couldn't get to Popo yesterday, but AmWager, the imputed odds option, which can mute some of the frustrations. I mean, when it comes to the movement of the downward movement, particularly of horses in price. But if players had a better handle on what they could anticipate the price is going to be on horses that they're looking at, and the imputed odd concept that can that can mute some of that annoying line movement, late line movement that comes with the, with the vast majority of handle coming in the last 3 minutes of, of the betting cycle. Thanks to Andy Beyer and Pat Cummings yesterday, Dick will give his perspective, and he's got historic context as well to offer. But then at 10:30, as promised, Maury Wolf will join us. And Maury probably is the most versed, I call them the most well-versed player of, of size and of, historic proportion and as a consultant to the game, and as a enormous bettor. Undoubtedly, at certain times, in terms of being an individual player, Maury as big or bigger than anyone. But as I've referenced many times when these discussions have come forward, and we've been discussing it for years and years and years here, Maury warned the industry that they had to have a proportion to control and to keep the CAW money from controlling too much, too great a percentage of the handle. And they've blown past those guardrails that Maury advised the industry to put up. And as you heard yesterday, between Andy and Pat, and just reading Raider's article in Financial Times, the industry is invested into this. At least a portion of the industry is. One large racetrack operator in particular, and it's not a secret. But if that handle that they provide, that the groups are providing, 30%, 32%, 36%, various. Pat wrote that piece about jackpot bets, and over 40% on force out days when it comes to the jackpot pick six. And as Andy, Andy was very focused on that yesterday. To some degree, Andy's visit yesterday, his concern about eliminating jackpot bets, something that he saw the problem with it, immediately. He was really focused on that even more than, the specific, size and influence, undue influence that the groups have the pools, but for our purposes, as somebody that that bets, $1,000, $1,500, $2,000, on a weekend. The influence that it has on our ability to keep the ball in the air, keep our churn going, bringing enough back to us as rank and file players. They're siphoning the value out of particularly, the exotic bets that we are utilizing as a way to bet small to win big. And that's a problem, obviously. What can you say? Everyone is seeing it and feeling it, and the question is, can the industry be convinced to collectively, I just wrote this actually in answer to our friend Jeff on a Twitter thread. Dave Aragona was nice enough to recommend that people listen to the segments from yesterday, Beyer and Cummings. Can the industry bite the bullet and take probably a 10 to 15% handle hit to rein the groups in? And if reined in, will the groups stay around? Frankly, I think they probably would. They can still do what they do and make their make their profit in a lot of ways through the rebating system. I want Dick to talk about rebating. And Maury can talk about it as well. And you know, people think, well, if you just slash takeout, you'll take away the rebate. They won't play. That's not that simple. It's not that one dimensional. So, Maury Wolf at 10:30, and I've got a series of questions for Maury to field, and we'll let him opine and provide the historical context and some of the mechanics. I reached out as well to Paul Matisse, who's been a frequent visitor when it comes to Paul's. Any reason to call Paul is a good reason, but Paul is, he's got a family thing going on, and so he's away, so probably, you know, maybe next week or certainly in advance of Derby, we'll get a chance to let Paul weigh in as well. And he thought he had some interesting elements that he's noticed in the way in which the pools are being marauded, essentially, suggesting, I'll ask Maury about this, suggesting that, in fact, they've somewhat either not changed their approach, but when it comes to win betting, that they're hammering favorites. If you saw the David Bernson quote about the public being a excellent barometer, it seems like, and part of this, of course, is maybe influenced by field size, and undoubtedly is partly influenced by field size, but it feels like, you know, favorites that used to be 6-5 and 7-5 are now 4-5 and 3-5 are being just pounded, right? Is that a fair, I thought that was an interesting observation, so I want Maury to touch on that. So, Maury Wolf, 10:30. It's Wednesday. Dick is going to join us here momentarily, and we'll do some Hong Kong and get his thoughts on topic. Sid Fernando, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale, and we'll catch up on a few of the other horses that we didn't get to last week. We had a pretty full docket, but if you fold in the results from this past weekend, and then look ahead to, we can certainly look ahead to speculate on the Santa Anita Derby and Wood participants and Bluegrass participants. We'll see what Sid's thoughts are. All right. And what else? Wednesday, Seth. We'll catch up with Seth, who, boy, how about Seth on the beach? Right? Was it Pauline? What was the move? Was that a French movie? The Pauline? Pauline on the beach? Seth Merrow on the beach. There was a lot of white skin. That's all I that's all I saw. he's such a good sport. We had so much fun. I really, you know, we didn't, frankly, it whistled by. We did a 45 minute, you know, paddock preview type show at Gulfstream on Saturday. And had, you know, had solid enough opinions. Got kind of, who was it? Which horse that there was? Yesterday's guest, Grand Motion, the affirmative lady. That was Dave Grenig. Dave Grenig's the man. Dave got us. Let's reach for Sid, for Dick, and I'm having trouble finding. All right, I'll find it. But I want to get Dick going in here. I think he's a little bleary-eyed, to be honest, after spending the evening in the hospital. Let me also take a moment and wish everybody that's celebrating a happy Passover. Pesach tonight, and I can't deliver brisket to Tina, and I will I will have to look for the Afikoman somewhere else because tonight we're going to be at the Kentucky Bread dinner at the apiary. So, Lenny Shulman got tied on to something, and he cannot be here live this morning, which is too bad. But maybe we'll get Lenny to come over tomorrow. I think he is going to come and be my plus one tonight. So they'll almost be a minion at the Kentucky Bread Awards dinner. I can't help myself. Dick Powell, good morning.
Steve, good morning.
How's she doing? What, you had a tough night, huh?
Yeah, she's fine. She's home. The Mary Lou Whitney John Hendrickson emergency room at Saratoga Hospital, where all the rooms have horse names in the ER.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah, well, her and I have spent way too much time there.
Yeah, I imagine.
So, but we're good.
All right. Well, I, you know, obviously we're gonna dig in and look at HKJC, but we were in connection last night because this is a topic that I've broached with you many times, and I that Financial Times piece. You know, there's so many things in it that are provocative and actually encouraging about the game and its future. But the, you know, the sword of Damocles here continues to be CAW and the money. And Dick, you've seen the rise of this. You've had your finger on the pulse in a lot of ways in your, you know, consultancy career and the companies you've been involved with. And so, you know, your input on this topic is absolutely as important and I would imagine insightful as anyone's.
Yes, and full disclosure, Racing and Gaming and Services,
RGS,
has been a client of mine since, 2005, I think. I mean, it's just crazy how long I've been with them. And the world has changed since then. And RGS invented the rebate industry. Kirk Brooks did so when he ran the Boardwalk in Las Vegas and started giving out rebates, triggered a chain of events that brought us the rebate industry that we know it as now. And so it's constantly evolving. I'm trying to go through my head because I did listen to everything last night, so I have it fresh, but I have it like in chronological order as I listen to
sure.
it. So with Andy, the pick six was a dying bet. The carryovers were getting embarrassingly small, you know, during the week. 12,000-15,000 weekend, maybe 25,000 if it didn't get hit. There was a number of factors that caused that. But the $2 pick six, which believe me, I'm all in favor of. My biggest scores were $2 pick sixes. I think it's the best bet. I never liked doing what the industry did. Like, just, I remember being in a conversation with an industry person, and I think I remember who it was, but I remember David Bernson was there, and it was three of us, and they were talking about the Magna 5, which was one of my favorite bets, because you get to bet five races, but it only took up an hour of your time. You'd have to sit there all day and watch six races to get knocked down the last leg or something. So the Magna 5 was a $2 bet, and it used to average over $550,000 each week. Then they dropped it to a dollar, and the Magna 5 dropped down to about $300,000 each week, and then it's gone. So the small bankroll allegedly is being accommodated, but the betting didn't keep up with the drop in $2 to $1, didn't double. So we have a pick six that's dying, and the industry decided, certainly not anything I was in favor of, going to this jackpot formula. So the jackpot formula has some pluses, has some minuses. Andy articulated the minuses very well. Some of the pluses are when there are enormous carryovers day to day, you can get a big overlay by hitting it, by hitting the six out of six and not being the lone ticket. That there's enough dead money in the pool because a lot of the dead money is people trying to get the only ticket. So they're playing long shot combinations that they probably wouldn't already play. So you'll see some nice overlays with the six horses that win. And you know, so it's not all negative. But I was kind of struck that Andy kind of seized on that, and obviously it's destroyed the $2 pick six, which I wish they would bring back. I just don't know how successful it would be if they brought it back, because besides the jackpot and 20 cent, we got 10 cent supers, we got all this encouragement of lowering minimums. So I think that did as much damage to the pick six as anything. So I would not blame the jackpot format for the demise of the pick six. On mandatory payout days, yeah, as Pat has documented, there's a lot of money in there from not only computer wagers but big bettors. And I think we've kind of blurred the line between big bettors, seven-figure bettors, and computer bettors, which are obviously more than seven-figure bettors. But there are some big bettors that are betting and not betting using computers to make their bets. So we have this situation where the jackpot is being paid out. There's a ton of CAW money in there, and Pat's done the research, so it's there. And yet, last Sunday, with the mandatory payout, because Andy said it hurts the little guy. Well, the little guy was able to bet 20 cents and make $8,000 with 13, 20, 7, 20, $12, 740 favorite, 760 favorite, $4.60 favorite. That's a pretty good return for the little guy if they danced around a couple of horses in the first and third legs. So I used to love the $2 pick six because I thought it helped the little guy. I thought with the carryovers, the little guy had a chance of maybe getting a chalky pick six that's going to pay two, three times what it should because of the carryover, because everyone chasing the big box car numbers. So that kind of struck me as I certainly didn't agree with that focus. I know that was Andy's focus, and he was riffing on that. And that's he's right about the demise of the pick six. I just don't think he had the actual. I just don't attribute it to the jackpot formulas. So we've taken players, created all these exotic bets for them, and trying to bet a little and win a lot and all that. And there's a large part of it that's just not working. But here's what is working. If you bet $1 million, Steve, and you get a 10% rebate, you're getting $100,000. I can guarantee you where that $100,000 is going. So now you have $1 million, and now you're probably going to bet $1.1 million. And $1.1 million would generate a $110,000 rebate, and so on and so forth. So the rebate not only keeps people at that level in the game, but it generates a tremendous amount of handle that we're looking at and we're thinking, well, if someone bet 70 million, they bet 70 million. Well, no, and the rebate generated a lot of that money. You talked about revenue yesterday, which is critical. But what no one talks about, if you look at handle as being flat, let's say handle's been flat the last 10 years. Revenue has gone up because the rates have gone up. I mean, anyone in this business that's buying signals is paying the highest rates they've ever paid. Now, what does that mean? That means revenue has been up for the racetrack sending out the signal. And under the Interstate Horse Racing Act, half of that revenue goes to purses. So 50% goes to the track, 50% goes to the purse fund. So when rates go up, even if handle stays flat, revenue goes up. Now, can we maintain what we've been maintaining? You know, it hits 12 million, seems to be suffering this year for some reason. 2023 so far is not a good year. But the rates have gotten extremely high, and that's generated a tremendous amount of revenue for the tracks themselves, which need to survive, and the purse funds for horsemen that need to survive. So that's, you know, that's what I was listening to last night in both interviews. Those were some of the things that struck me and stood out.
Dick, I want you actually to do a real service here, because you talk about the advent of rebating. Can you provide a primer, the history of rebating, the structure, and help people understand what's involved here and what kind of volume? To some degree, I think people, players of smaller capacity, don't even realize that there are rebates available to even almost the smallest player. I mean, technically, the smallest player who is getting, let's say, you know, bonus points for their, you know, for their play, that is a form of a rebate. You may not realize, you know, Jerry Brown has tried to popularize this concept with the Thoroughgraph Player Services, that players of any size at all are due a rebate, and if you ask and if you seek out a rebate, you may not realize that your play qualifies, and your ADW might very well provide you with a rebate. So if you don't mind, because we have not done this enough over the years, explain the rebating system and the tiers and what's involved.
It started. Kirk started it at a years ago. You didn't have race books inside of casinos. They were separate entities in Las Vegas, and Kirk was running one, and it was very successful. Paul and Duke have talked about back then, and it was widely viewed as the good old days, and I'm sure it was. And then what happened was the bigger casinos saw the Boardwalk doing so good that they got together and they got California to not send signals and pass some laws or whatever, so that kind of put a big stop in the rebate industry in Las Vegas. But what it did was a lot of people moved to Las Vegas to participate, and when the rebates in person weren't available in Vegas, Kirk built this company, which originally was to have a way for dog track players to bet interstate. So in other words, I'm a dog track player in this state and I want to bet a dog track in another state. Well, that really wasn't possible back then. So if you ever look at the RGS logo, there is a greyhound in the logo. So that's when RGS started. The reason we're in St. Kitts is there was no place in America to host a pool. There was no Oregon, there was no North Dakota. None of that existed. So we needed a place to do it. We needed an English-speaking country, which St. Kitts was. They had a good business climate, and we've been great partners with the people down there for 20-something years. So that's where it got started. The model is just very simple. It's a volume discount. But what I think everyone gets wrong with is the thing you just said is absolutely true. But it's been viewed as, you know, only the big guys get the rebates. Well, anyone can get a giant rebate. I could get it. You could get it. We just don't bet enough to get the volume discount. I can't go to the Wynn and say, I want the presidential suite. They're going to say, Mr. Powell, we watched you playing blackjack with $5 chips, and you're not eligible. And they're right. So it's all based on business, how much business you're generating. And the part that is not really defined very well is the business model is basically, let's say takeout is 21%, just for argument purposes, and the rate is 7%. So 7% goes to the track, 7% goes to purses. Well, where does the other 7% go? Well, everyone thinks we keep the entire 7%. No, we give almost all of it back to the bettor. So they get, sometimes depending on the pool and the takeout in the pool, they might be getting rebates that, you know, approach pretty good size numbers. But that's the model where they're able to do their business. We, because it's a boutique operation with a limited number of customers, we're able to service them, and they're able to generate the handle that they've generated over the years. So the part that everyone, I think, gets wrong is they think the rebate shop makes all this money. And you know, yes, I've worked for them for 18 years. They're still paying me. But the focus is on the player. And the player gets a massive amount of what's left after the host fee is paid for. So as host fees go up, guess who's not getting as much money out of it? No, that's fine. And every big bettor I know has openly talked about favoring lower takeout. So you see people say, well, if takeout's 25%, they're getting a 20% rebate, so they don't want to see takeout lower than 20% because then they'd get a lower rebate. Well, duh. But we're all in favor of lower takeout because we want more liquidity in the pools. We want a successful industry to participate in. I mean, our customers, many have horses. I mean, you've met Dana Parm. Dana owns over 300 harness horses. You know, this thing about, you know, just the total mechanization, nothing involved. Yeah, yes, obviously there's computerization. And another point, Steve, that gets glossed over. Most of the computer teams, I can't speak for all of them, I really can't speak for any of them, but my knowledge is such that they bet every breed, every track, every race, every pool. So when you're seeing a race that might have been affected by last second odds change, you know, Andy's a thing with the effective takeout, stuff like that, the money is spread out from the individual team across an enormous amount of events. And thus the computerization in order to do that. So I think people don't really grasp how much the player gets back, what they're doing with that money, and the positive benefits of that. Now, yes, we've been talking about the negative things with the late odds changes and open up a Pandora's box to the public as far as, well, gee, what's going on here? And I'm sick of this, and you know, I can't, and I want to bet fixed odds and things like that. So it's just, you know, it's just something that I blame ourselves, and RGS has been the most vocal and visible rebate shop of everybody. I mean, we're at every conference. I will speak in public. I will respond to various things that I see written and stuff like that, and try to correct different things. We're out there, and maybe we should do a better job, and maybe the whole rebate industry should just do a better job instead of, you know, just being too far in the shadows.
Would this be a good time to remind people, and I should go try to find some of Fred Pope's work that, you know, appeared in the TDN for many years, and Satish used to weigh in on it, the inverted pyramid, you know, the concept of the problematic element of the way in which the away from racetrack business developed, and the fact that, you know, the bricks and mortar have the greatest overhead, and the ADW elements and don't have to put on the show. They've got overhead, but not like the racetracks do, and yet they are getting a disproportionate amount of revenue generation. It feels like, and this has gone on behind the scenes, and you know, maybe this is a good spot for, you know, some of the people who negotiate signals, but the tracks have been kind of slowly trying to claw back some of that percentage that was given away too freely going back to the 70s and 80s, and the introduction of off-track betting, and of course nowhere was it done worse than in New York. What's your thought on that portion of this equation, Dick?
Yeah, I wouldn't say disproportionate, because now just about every track is in the ADW business.
Out of necessity.
But why isn't creativity rewarded?
That's a loaded question. I don't disagree, and I'll give you the ideal example of this. When we were having the discussion originally with Pat Cummings about the breakage issue, I made the suggestion that why couldn't an ADW give their customers, be creative, and give their customers the breakage as a marketing advantage? They still could. For places that are set a new standard. But the creativity portion, and Steve Crist banged that drum for years about the only way to grow the business is with new bets and innovation and creativity. I'm a believer.
Well, yes, and I'll give you an example. When NTRA started, they went around, and their business model was based on TVG succeeding. And by succeeding, I mean basically being the only ADW out there. And they had a business plan that included $1.5 billion bet at TVG. Now, they do that now, but they didn't do that back then. And it didn't take into account, what about all the existing ADWs? Now, think about this, Steve. New York City OTB was doing $200 million a year on their phone betting. That they were doing $1 billion a year in a handle, and $200 million came from the phone betting, which is ADW. It wasn't internet, it wasn't electronic, it was just operators answering the phone, taking
right.
bets. And yet, NTRA wanted to take over all those companies that had been built, like an RGS, like the others. And it was like, you know, we invented the business. That should count for something. And now, after all these years, yes, the bricks and mortar tracks have said, hey, we should be in the ADW business. Okay, go ahead. But it's that's why I disagree with the disproportionate part of it, because the expense is really not just our expense, but the players' expense. That the players that have these computer teams, and in that article in the Financial Times, Scott says, how many people work with the Equine Edge? I mean, it was quite a number, because that stuck out when I was reading it. And these computer teams, it's not an algorithm. It's this team has this team has that, and it's all modeling. And it sometimes it just doesn't work. and they're not beating the takeout, and they have to change the model, and they need more software people in there and stuff like that. So I'm not comparing that to running a racetrack, because clearly that's not the case. And in the beginning, yes, because getting back to New York OTB, they used to pay 2% for signals because they had such mass marketing power that they could negotiate tracks. Remember back then, you were only allowed to simulcast in between thoroughbred and harness. You're only allowed to do one out-of-state track a day. You know, then it went to two, then it went to unlimited. But the rates didn't correspondingly go up when OTB expanded their markets. So, yeah, it started out way too low, and tracks and horsemen were not getting what they should. But that certainly has flipped to where the rates are. The rates can only go so high. I mean, takeout is only so high, and the rate can only be so high with taking everyone's business expenses into account. So, yeah, the ADWs can have a negative effect on bricks and mortars, but I don't know, the bricks and mortar business model has not kept up only because of gaming hasn't been able to survive. And, you know, this is like something that I'm not saying the bricks and mortar tracks don't care, but there's money out there and there's money coming in, and they're not examining it with a fine-tooth comb for various reasons. And then we're partners with I mean, anyone who knows me knows I have really good relationships with HBPAs and horseman groups. I mean, Rick Violet was tremendous dealing with NYTHA, stuff like that. But part of it was they understood intuitively what the revenue split was and how they were not getting that anywhere else. So there's you know, there's what we used to say, there's 10 cent dollars and 2 cent dollars, and New York OTB used to be 2 cent dollars, and a rebate shop used to be 5 cent dollars. Well, now that's obviously probably doubled. And New York OTB and the OTBs in New York State have all had to pay higher for signals, and rightfully so. But it's there's a point that it's revenue's not going to, rates are not going to go much higher. So now we're in the danger zone of revenue being flat and the purse contribution being flat, unless handle were to miraculously go up.
Well, handle can gravitate. Is that a fair? I mean, if handle stays flat collectively, there's certainly going to be you know, money gravitating in certain directions, and I think we're seeing that right now, frankly, in Kentucky, right? That has become obvious, and the more attractive the wagering propositions, as you know, essentially as presented with field size and competitiveness. I mean, look at this Turfway meet. You know, Keeneland got this opening day card, and then you've got, you know, capacity fields that you're looking at. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but certainly tomorrow and Friday. But you know, there's economic pressures that are going to injure, you know, certain venues. It just feels like certain jurisdictions are going to be poised for long-term success, and Kentucky being really, you know, one of them, and others are going to be in trouble.
Yes, and Kentucky has prospered primarily because of historic horse racing machines, right, and the revenue that has generated. The investment in Turfway Park was big, and Topeda is a big factor. I have friends, they say, oh, I hate Gulfstream. You know, they come off the turf and they run in that stupid Topeda. And I said, well, what part don't you like? The 10-horse fields? You know, the competitive racing? Why does that bother you so much? You should be embracing it. And Turfway was a perfect example of that. If you have a surface that is safe for horses, and maybe horses can run 173.5 weeks instead of 175 weeks, that has a big difference with your filling races. And the results were tremendous this winter. And also it gets them over the bad weather doldrums that Turfway Park used to endure, you know, running in the winter in northern Kentucky and what that involved. So that's kind of out of the equation. Big fields are there and the betting followed. Yeah. So the purses that generated the betting that, and it's, this is, as a New Yorker, this is really dangerous for New York because, you know, New York, we throw a lot of things at horsemen and owners and people like that. Make it a not necessarily a business-friendly climate. And then now you got a big alternative where many of the horses are already eligible with KTDF. So that's going to be tough for New York to keep up. Sounds like, how's that possible? But I think we're seeing it already. I think we saw it this winter.
No, can't argue. There's a whole probably special episode to do on that alone. Let me before we talk and fit Hong Kong in, Dick. Let me round out your expertise with kind of the same question that you know will be a big portion of the discussion with Maury. What is a practical solution to where we have arrived in terms of, I mean, let's say it's between 30 and 35% with CAW money, and you know the number. I mean, Maury will tell us from his experience, but you know the original number that was supposed to be a barrier was about 20%. Is it practical to think we can dial the groups back and you know with you know, look at what NYRA has done with the retail only pools that that they've created and you know specified you know what's a workable solution to you know, sort of negating to some degree the influence that the groups are having on the pools?
Well, I think dialogue is a big start. And I think whatever the solution, whether it's what NYRA did, closing whips or, you know, earlier for right. computer players, things like that, as long as it's fair and equitable and evenly enforced. So when NYRA did what they did, I don't know if they fixed this. Probably not because they're changing tote companies. But that was kind of done on a voluntary basis. In other words, it wasn't done by tote. Tote didn't identify these 20 TRA codes and say they stopped betting at this point. That, you know, based on post time, that was not the case. So there has to be some level of trust that whatever the solution is, it gets applied to everyone and it gets applied equitably. Now, one thing is kind of sidebar, but I just stirred memory. You mentioned yesterday about different rates, and some people might be paying different rates.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably true. But it makes sense because the small players, no matter what I hate to say this, but no matter what the small players say, they're not takeout sensitive. They talk about it, or most of them just don't pay attention to it because the witness the pools that they gravitate, which have the highest takeouts. So with the rates, it's not necessarily, in other words, the higher the rate doesn't necessarily generate the most revenue. There's a kill shot in there that might be between 0 and 10. Let's say 0 is unrealistic. 10 is probably unrealistic. So somewhere in there, for this better, they might bet the maximum at that rate. And it's going to benefit you, and it's going to benefit them. So let's do it. But if you're going to apply the rate to everybody, well, then you might be hurting some people and helping some people, and just I can understand how rates can be different. I also can understand how they're private. These are businesses. This is competition. And we can't disclose everything we're doing because it's competitive industry. So that popped in my head because I remember that was part of the conversation yesterday. Yep. So with fair and equitable, yeah, I think everyone would embrace it because no one wants to see the game suffer and no one wins if the game suffers.
Right.
We're all losers when the game suffers. And like I said, Dana, back when Dana was Dana, openly embraced lower takeout. So, yes, if it's a solution that is applied and everyone has the same treatment, great. And I don't know how that's going to happen. Someone identified 15 CAW teams, and one of them was RGS. So we're at a disadvantage as far as clout within the rebate industry itself. You know, there's a horse racing industry, and then there's the rebate industry, and we are who we are, and we're creative and do a great job with what we have, but we're still one of 15 that wield that level of influence. So I don't have an answer to your question, Steve. But as people come up with solutions of let's try this, let's try that, whatever, as long as it's done for everybody, fine. I don't know how anyone could oppose that. It's just a matter of everyone, you know, being in the boat rowing the same direction.
And that's a big ask. It's a big listen, and that's not confined. That's not confined to our industry. I mean, it's
competition. You got to remember, with us, we do not own a racetrack. We do not own a tote company. So we're kind of out there.
Yeah, you're literally on an island.
We are.
Hey now.
Yes, in the Caribbean.
This stuff writes itself, folks. Dick, I appreciate it. You're always open and honest and direct about this topic, these topics, and it's greatly appreciated. Let me round out before we bring Sid in. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hillendale. HK, let's get our Hong Kong in.
Okay, a little different schedule this week. We're running tomorrow instead of today. So tomorrow we have a 9-race card. Saturday night, Sunday. Now, Steve, even I don't know the answer to this question. I got to find out. Sunday is Easter, and
New York
does not allow betting in the on Easter.
No,
and yet there's a big race card in Hong Kong, and I don't know if you're able to advance bet it or. I don't know. I was looking. I'm like, wow, that's kind of threw me a curveball. So, tremendous card. Saturday night, Sunday morning, Chairman's Trophy, 1600 meters. California Spangle is kind of avoiding the sprint level because the Sprint Cup, the other Group 2 on the night, has Lucky Swinehouse, Computer Patch, all these top sprinters, and Lucky Swinehouse beat California Spangle going 7 furlongs. Now that race turns back to 6. California Spangle stretches out to a mile, and he's won at a mile. He's beaten the Golden 60 at a mile, and his speed is probably more dangerous going a mile than in a short sprint. So two terrific stake races this weekend, depending on where you live. You might be able to watch and wager on. You'll definitely be able to watch them. They will be fun. Tomorrow, I'll give you a quick pick 3 to finish out the card, 7, 8, 9. And if you go to hkjc.com, click on current odds. You can already look at tomorrow's odds because it's 24 hours out from the race. So race 7, I like 5 and 7, and they were 4-1 and 6-1. So Helene Feeling, Zach Purton, Danny Shum is a 3-year-old taking on older, but gets a little bit of a weight concession. And HK Dragon, Doug White, and Lyle Hewitson, that's been a potent combination for you. So 5 and 7 in the first leg. Second leg is a heavy favorite. Number 2, Sung Pak Fu, is odds on in the betting, and rightfully so. He's won his last 2 and doesn't move up out of the class 4 handicap. He has to pick up weight, but he still stays within that range. But the one horse, E Brother, is 16-1, and he kind of looks every bit as good. They're both carrying similar weight. So I'm going to go 1, 2, and 8. Snow a lot from David Hayes. So we're going to use the favorite because we have to, but we're also going to spread. So we're going to go 1, 2, and 8 in the second leg, race 8. But the 2's already taking a ton of money. And then the last race, we're going to go 5 and 10. Winning Icy from Casper Founds. Now, Casper's had a kind of a quiet year. He's had 29 wins. I mean, he's in the top 5-6 trainers, but not the usual Happy Valley dominance. So Winning Icy looks like it's in good form. Has been rallying strong at Happy Valley. And Luke Ferraris is going to ride. So I like the 5, Winning Icy. And the 10 will be the favorite. Right now, the 10 is... big favorite, Haas. Jamie Richards, Zach Purr, they've combined for 11 wins from 45 mounts. Combined this year, the last couple of starts, this horse has been at Happy Valley. And just won as easy as could be last time out from post 11. Now we do a post 3. He'll be tough, but we'll throw in the 5 as well. So 5 and 7, race 7. 1, 2, 8, race 8. 5 and 10, race 9. That's the old, as Harvey Peck would say, the Woolworth race 9.
2 by 3 by 2 in the Happy Valley late pick 3 tomorrow, and we'll keep an eye on it, although we'll be pretty immersed by tomorrow in the weekend handicapping, because we'll have all the cards at hand, which actually, as a closing question, Dick, any thoughts about the two Derby preps over the weekend? Florida Derby winner and Arkansas Derby winner. Forte had to work really hard to get the victory, although in the end, he won clear. And Angel of Empire kind of blew out that Arkansas Derby.
Yes. My gut reaction to Forte is we've seen his development. That there's, I'm not saying there's no more gas in the tank, because Todd can bring him back and run that same race again. But I don't see him moving forward. That's just me.
Right.
And he was game. He was wide. It was a terrific race, but I think that's his race. I don't think there's anything better on the horizon. Brad Cox's horse was really good.
Yeah.
Of course, I don't remember the jock, but the minute that it didn't really matter, but the minute he pressed a button, whoosh, and it's just like he, like a Trevor would say, jumped in at the quarter ball.
Flavian Pratt.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. He goes from flight line to this one. So yeah, I was very impressed with him. Hard to tell who he beat, you know, those kind of lurking questions, but he was very, very good. So yes, those two were good. We should see 6 more Derby starters this week, with the top 2 finishers getting more than enough points to get in the starting gate. And so that'll be fun to watch. Hopefully weather will cooperate. How warm is it down there, Steve? I heard it was going to be 85 there today.
It's humid this morning and warm, but it's a temperature supposed to drop starting Friday. It's supposed to cool off considerably.
Because I know the Masters is supposed to get rain, so I don't know if that's going to hit Keeneland. I hope not. Because they get all that grass racing and stuff.
But. Well, hold on. I mean, I did not look back. I only heard or looked the other day. Let's take a look. Lexington. Let's see what we got. Lexington weather. Here we go. WDKY. Yeah, you're right. 85. Holy cow. It was humid this morning because I've been walking out with a vest on, and today was the first morning that it was not didn't seem necessary. Why is it? What they did, losing the here we go about we're going to talk about the dark sky, which was the absolute greatest. Here we go. All right. Here we go. Precise location. Considering that I'm sitting right here at considering I'm sitting at Keeneland. All right, there's the 10-day, finally. My God. Yeah, it's going down to 50 tonight. And just cloudy. I think we're good. There might be some rain tomorrow. But we're talking Saturday, they're talking 59 and cloudy at a low of 41. So the cool, yeah, it's going to be cool. And I imagine after some rain, feels like that main track will be tight as a drum.
Good. Well, that's good to hear. Fingers crossed, good racing for the weekend, and then we got most of our starters in the Derby ready to analyze replays, all that good stuff.
Well, Dick, I appreciate this valuable time spent. You're the best. I appreciate it.
All right, Steve. Thanks a lot. Talk to you next week.
You got it. Dick Powell, everybody, and you got some historic context to rebating and that perspective, as well as Dick's feel for CAW and where we are and where we might go. Right now we're going to go to Sid Fernando. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. Looking forward to this. And we're familiar, obviously, with the two winners of the two Derby of this past week. We've certainly talked about Forte plenty as Breeders' Cup Juvenile Champion and Angel of Empire. We had the chance to talk about after Risen Star, but we'll touch on them both. And I've got a couple of questions about the Oaks Fillies, and then we'll look at some of the key players when it comes to the weekend ahead. First things first, Sid Fernando, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Excellent.
How do you like Lexington?
I should inform everybody. Hammer thought he was going to, he thought that he had exhausted his travel woes on his way to Florida. No. No sooner does he leave, I was sitting here, I was putting up the listing for the show yesterday, and all of a sudden I get a call. I figure, oh, he's, he's calling to tell me the flight was canceled. So yeah. His 2 o'clock flight out of Lexington, heading back to California, got canceled. He got pushed back to 5:30. And so I went and picked him up and went over to Ramsey's Diner on Harrodsburg Road and had a great lunch. And then I dropped him off. He was going to read a book a couple of hours. He was, going to relax. I got a text from him this morning. He didn't get home to California, to his house, until 5:30 Eastern time. So 2:30 in the morning. So the trip back was harrowing. So I feel terrible for Hammer. He had trouble getting here, getting to the East Coast, and he had trouble getting home.
Wow, and I can relate to that because I have a similar story. Saturday morning, Cynthia and I were supposed to take a 9:30 flight, or no, a 10 o'clock flight to New York on Saturday morning, because Joe, my son, was opening a gym on Sunday at 1 o'clock in Tribeca. Well, at 9, we get a text message. our flight to New York was canceled.
Yeah.
And so we just, I said, let's just jump in the car. And we drove from 9:30 all the way till 2:30 in the morning, got to Baltimore, spent the night, now Sunday at 2:30 in the morning, got up at 9 and drove to New York for 4 hours, and got there just at 1 o'clock, Steve, just in time for the opening. Then we left the opening at 4, drove back to Baltimore, spent the night.
Oh, my God.
And then on Monday, we drove all the way straight back to Tampa. So in a three-day span, we had 48 hours in the car.
Oh, my God. That's nuts. I saw the picture of you and Cece with Joe at the gym.
Yeah.
Very excited for him.
That. Thank you very much. I know. Posted that on Twitter and Instagram. Joe and a friend of his, they opened up a gym, 371 Canal in Tribeca. It's a calisthenics gym with bars and so forth. And so the only weight you're using is only your body weights. And anybody in New York, if you want to get in shape, go over there. And if you mention my name, you get the friends and family rate. So let me put that out there.
Is it just called the address, or what is that? What's the moniker?
The name of the gym is called Limitless NYC. Limitless NYC. They got a great website. And they're three guys. They're in this calisthenics group in New York called Team Sparta, which is like apparently one of the best. And so they just opened up this gym right in, you know, it's a real fashionable area right near Chinatown, obviously below in Tribeca. Tribeca is the triangle below Canal, and it's at 371 Canal. And it's called Limitless NYC. And, you know, these two young guys, they're excited about it. They had a great grand opening. And, you know, Cynthia and I were fortunate to get there just in time. We, you know, we weren't going to miss it. So that's why we just jumped in the car and said, let's go. Yeah.
Well, and here they're on Twitter, Limitless Fitness, and their address is Limitless NYC is their Twitter address. Limitless FitnessNY.com if you want to look at the website. And you know, it's funny, the only thing, Sid, people make fun of me about my prodigious eating habits and the things I enjoy, but that I don't seem to, you know, get pudgy. The only exercise.
You must have a very good metabolism.
I do, and so as I say, it's a high motor. But when it comes to fitness, the only thing I'll do is swim. However, what I think I've told this story before, and you'll get a big kick out of it. There was a point where I must have been. Either a freshman in college, the summer after freshman in college, and I was feeling a little paunchy, and I thought, you know, I see these guys, and they're all, you know, I'm broadcasting, so I see all these athletes. So I wanted to do something, but I'm just not I wasn't going to run, I don't like that. And swimming was really the only long-term exercise I've done consistently. However, I sent away for the Charles Atlas course. I kid you not, like literally off the back of a comic book. And,
yeah, I remember those back then.
Well, and you get it. It's 15 lessons, and people may laugh, but it works spectacularly well, and you'll learn what they're doing is isometrics, and that's all that the Charles Atlas course is. It's dynamic tension.
Right.
And it's something you can actually do. You don't need any equipment. It's amazing.
That's the thing here. And you can use, you know, playground bars.
Yeah.
For pull-ups and, you know,
chairs
and all that stuff.
Two kitchen one of the basic exercises in the Charles Atlas course is to take two kitchen chairs and do push-ups with your hands right on the chair and drop down below the chair level and come back up. I mean, you can literally, while you're working at your desk, drive your fists into each other, into the palm of each hand. And that's an exercise. Locking your fingers, locking your index fingers and pulling on each other and putting it up over your head and behind your head. And the great way to tone your arms. I mean, the thing was amazing. And it literally, within like a couple of weeks, somebody said to me, "Vicky, are you working out?" And I was like, oh my God, this is literally the 90-pound weakling, scenario. And it's so funny. And the best part is, when I told my father, I learned something about his neighborhood in either Bay Ridge or Bensonhurst when he was growing up. Charles Atlas lived in Brooklyn. And used to work out on the lawn, and people in the neighborhood and kids. And my father said they would go the Italian name, and Italian or Greek, and very cool. I never heard that story.
That's a great story. And bro, you went from you became the big man on campus.
Not exactly, but I still never got further than the broadcast booth. That was as far. although you know what.
Well, I have noticed that, you know, as you say, you're prodigious eating and you're road eating. I've always marveled at how trim you are in person.
It's funny. Well, the swimming gave me the shoulders. I swam quite a bit competitively, the country club and all that. And then, you know, from there, I rode crew at Colgate. Now it's a varsity sport, but when I was there, it was a club sport, and it was just getting going. And I was on one of the first road second oar for the heavyweight eight. And we weren't very good, but it was a great experience. We finished eighth at the head of the Charles.
Oh wow, that's great.
That wasn't so bad. I don't know how we went off into this direction, but here we are. Sid, let's get a couple of licks in, and I do want to ask about the Phillies before we talk about the boys for a minute. And one bittersweet aspect that came up yesterday with Graham Motion, we talked about Affirmative Lady. Here's another great at stake winner for Arrogate, and it is just. Every time another horse of his emerges here, you just realize what a tragedy it is that he's gone. At the same time, I suppose the watch is on for, you know, a son of his to carry on and to also carry on for Unbridled Song.
Yeah, we've talked about it on your show so often about it got down to the end. Only a few sons of Unbridled Song were viable names to carry Unbridled Song forward. Unbridled Song was a terrific stallion. His daughters have become outstanding broodmares. And, of course, the missing link was, you know, he'd get a stallion here and there. That stallion would show some stuff and then kind of disappear. And so he didn't have a really, really top-level stallion to stick. Now, mind you, Midshipman is a very good stallion at Darley. But, you know, he's fluctuated in that range between 7,500 and now 20. Very good stallion, though. But Unbridled Song was really not getting a kind of an elite stallion. Although he had quite a few sons, and a lot of it rested on Arrogate's shoulders when he went to stud. So, to your point about the loss, it's magnified not just because we lost a really great horse, and obviously the death of that horse was devastating to his owners, Judd Mott, but to the industry at large, it was also quite a big loss, as you point out. Because he had three crops, and he got Kentucky Oaks winner from his first crop, and she's back this year as a four-year-old. That's the D. Wayne Lucas filly, and then he's got an excellent son in
talking to Bob Baffert and Cave Rock, who I think is, you know, he's going to have a career at stud, no question about it. So, we keep, you know, Graham Motion just unveiled this one. There's Tell Me No Lies, who's running in the Santa Anita Oaks. So there's been quite a few really good runners for the Stallion, and it is a shame. There's one other son of Unbridled Song that's having a very nice career, and that's Liam's Map at Lane's End. But it seems like, you know, and Liam's Map, by the way, you know, he's already sired 4 grade one winners. But Arrogate, really, from what we're seeing, had that stuff. You know, he had the right stuff. He was a horse that wasn't going to really get you precocious horses. But, you know, as his pedigree and his own racing style indicated, they come to form at 3, and that's what's happening.
Well, I do want to ask one follow-up question because of her pedigree. Has got a couple of interesting elements. The female family, the Damn Stift, who is a daughter of Stephen Got Even, who, you know, is a solid enough as a stallion, strictly really a dirt stallion. It might be one of the worst turf influences in history, but there's a name in her pedigree that I just never see as a broodmare sire. Third Dam, Sid, Full and Fancy, is out of a full-out mare, Full Twirl, but she herself is by Marfa. I can't think of any time I've seen a Marfa in a pedigree like this.
Yeah, you know, it gets back to a lot of these obscure stallions that you bring up. What tends to happen is that if they're not very successful sires, they kind of disappear from the landscape, right? And so occasionally where you find them is in the female line somewhere. There was a good horse by Marfa that might have been a mare that ends up having a chance to continue at stud. Now, in her case, Full and Fancy was a stakes winner, and she was a grade 3 stakes winner, or a grade 3 stakes placed, as I should say. She won the Next Move Handicap grade 3. So, yeah, she was a grade 3 stakes winner. She had plenty of opportunities at stud. You notice that, again, the negative kind of influence of Marfa in the sense of a stallion, even though she was a grade 3 winner herself, and she was bred to De Hare, Silver Deputy, whatnot, she really only produced one stakes horse that was a grade 3 placed horse called Half Metal Jacket by Yes It's True. So she herself, you know, you can see how Marfa, even though she was a stakes winner and a graded winner by Marfa, she really didn't do much, but she did get the second dam, that Silver Deputy dam, who was unraced. That's the second dam of Affirmative Lady. And that mare ended up producing 2 stakes winners, both by the AP Indy line. One was Speaking by Mr. Speaker, who's now in Texas, and the other was Stiffed by Stephen Got Even. Now, Stephen, that mare Stiffed is, a graded stakes winner. Just a black type winner, right? Yeah. And graded placed. Well, that's the dam of Affirmative Lady. So she was then bred to Arrogate and got Affirmative Lady. And it's, you know, when you look at these pedigrees, there's really kind of a history of bloodlines too, you know. And what you brought up about Marfa, by chance, Marfa's name reappears here in the female line, because going back to the third dam, he happened to get that graded winner who was given an opportunity at stud. Now, there were really, you know, Marfa didn't do that well, so you're not going to see too many sons of his that went to stud and carried on a male line. But he does appear in the female line this way, and that's the story about a lot of these obscure stallions. You know, they'll have a daughter, and that daughter will, you know, continue on.
Well, this what's it? You know, Marfa, of course, was Wayne Lucas, and one thing I just noticed that, because I hadn't even thought about it, I see that Tom Gentry bred Marfa, and what's interesting is this is the second time Gentry's have come up in 2 weeks, and who was it last week that the Gentry's had bred one of the I don't know if it was in two Phil's family, or I'll go find it, but it's just kind of funny. I mean, here's a filly that's going to end up on the Oaks Trail, obviously, and there's a few things going. I'm just looking at the female family. You've got Colonel Bradley is involved here as well. I see Bradley blood and all kinds of things going on. Here's a name from Maryland, Mo Feingold.
Mm-hmm.
Stratmat, who got that damn gray matter. Marfa's a damn. There's all kinds of things. There's all kinds of funny things. Marfa was a complete outcross.
Yeah, Marfa was a really good-looking horse. George, it was raced by George Fund, who was based in Illinois. I think his stable name was something like Quarter B Farm. And that horse, was then given to Lucas and was a very, very good racehorse. And I kind of remember he was a very good looking horse, a son of Foolish Pleasure. And, it's just another case history of, you know, sometimes some great horses, really fine runners, they just don't make it at stud. It's so hard, Steve, to make a stallion to begin with, you know?
Sure.
Some of them are in great horses' pedigrees. I mean, that's just the history of the sport.
Exactly, and it's again one of those things that just makes, you know, that makes the game so fascinating. And you know, looking at Marfa's pedigree, there's so many elements here. That Strat Matt I mentioned, Mo Feingold was a son of Lochinvar, who was a son of Case Ace. Case Ace from the, you know, from the 30s, who was an important sire.
Case Ace was the broodmare sire of Raisinative.
Raisinative, absolutely.
And Case Ace is important because he was the son of Teddy. And, you know, if you want to talk about how amazing things are, Teddy had, you know, sons like Sir Galahad and his full brother, Bulldog. But Teddy... they were imports, but then Teddy himself was imported to this country as an 18-year-old and ape stallion. And while he was here, and he had a few crops here, and one of those crops was Case Ace. And so it was just fortuitous that, you know, Case Ace came about only because Teddy got imported late in life.
There's no shortage of those kinds of influences. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm terrific.
Good,
always.
Hopefully I'm
gonna get licensed. There you go. How fun. There's so many.
Where are you set up over there?
We're back at the back ring. I'm in my back ring location. It's fabulous.
Oh, So there must not be many people there.
No, there's actually, you'd be surprised, because licensing is going on, so there's all kinds of people that are, you know, coming back to town, coming back from Florida or from Oaklawn or from Fairgrounds, and they came back with the horses, and the barns are full, and people are, you know, they got to get their licenses renewed and whatnot. So
how long will you be in Lexington for?
I'll stay through Saturday, Bluegrass Day, and then Sunday I meet up with the woman I'm married to, Tina Bump, Tina Bump Luke Bick, and we're going to meet up in New Orleans Sunday, Easter Sunday. We're going to Galatoire's for Easter dinner, and we're staying at the Pantalba.
Are you driving? Or
no,
flying?
I'm flying. I'm going to fly. No, I'm flying, and we're just spending like five nights. It's her spring break, and so she wanted to go. She heard me talking to Ben Bacik in Vegas, and Ben said, you got to come stay in the apartment. They've got the apartment.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Yeah.
That's excellent.
They've got the apartment.
Oh, that's going to be a nice little break on this road trip for you, isn't it?
Yes, frankly, it is, because then I go home for a week, and then we'll drive to Louisville, and
Are you both driving to Louisville?
No, she's not coming to Derby at all this year. We reoriented for her. She's going to be meeting me in Nashville because we're going to Iroquois. We'll be broadcasting Thursday and Friday ahead of the Iroquois Steeplechase at Percy Warner.
Oh, wow.
So we're going to stay in Louisville after Derby, and we'll do the recapping shows from Kentucky Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, drive to Nashville, and do Thursday and Friday there, and then Sunday drive to Baltimore for Preakness Week.
Boy, you got a busy schedule ahead of you, bro.
I'm like a boulder going downhill, Sid, gaining momentum.
Yeah. Well, you're bringing us all the racing action from around the hot spots.
Exactly, and I'm having a ball doing it. Let me roll
now,
in.
Now, don't you have to get off at 10:30? 10:30 to get Maury Wolf on?
I do, and so we got about 3 minutes, the bottom of the hour. We'll take a break, and then Maury will join us. But, Sid, Brad Cox reminded me on Monday, or was it Tuesday? Was it yesterday? When was Brad on? Monday. Whatever. Monday.
Mm-hmm.
He reminded us that there's now 3 Albaugh runners likely for Derby. So congratulations to Dennis. And
Dennis and Jason have 2 with Brad. Jason's Road and Angel of Empire. And Angel of Empire, by the way, was a 70,000 yearling from a later book at Keeneland. And kudos to Jason for hunting that far back to get it. He's also got Cyclone Mischief with Dale Romans. So they've got 3, but Brad also has, for our clients, Gary and Mary West, he's got Punch Bowl in the Ashland.
And Hit Show.
And Hit Show in the Wood.
Yeah.
So we've got some clients with Brad that are loaded pretty much to, you know, get into the classics.
And then some. Excited for them. And I had forgotten about Jace's Road. Was already out of sight, out of mind. It's starting. We're starting to get serious, obviously, this weekend. And is there anything you want to touch on with the prospective fields? The rest of the side.
I'm really looking forward to seeing Punch Bowl in the Ashland because she's going to get a severe class test because that's going to be a top field with Wonder Wheel and Julia Shining and, you know, some heavy hitters.
Yep.
And she's got 2 wins on her, you know, a maiden special and the allowance. So that's going to be a real big class test for her. But she looks super promising, Steve. Hit Show looks, you know, Hit Show, Brad brought him up from Fairgrounds to Keeneland, and he had to work Saturday in 59.4, on his way to New York. So he seems like he's in really good shape. It's been a Brad Cox story this year. I mean, he's been so deep in the three-year-old division. And, you know, I was just thinking about it. You know, he could have three, maybe four in the Derby. You got Todd Fletcher with potentially, you know, three or four in the Derby. I mean, between the two of them, you know, they could have six or seven runners in there.
Yep. No doubt. And I'm just looking for those that didn't, I haven't had a chance yet this morning. The Ashland, which goes as the ninth on this terrific Keeneland opening day card. Pride of the Nile for Doug O'Neill with the Tory coming to town. Drew the Rail coming out of the Santa Isabel. Wonder Wheel out of the Neck Beat in the Suncoast, but plenty of nice horses, notably Royal Delta, thinking back, got beat in the Suncoast. Tyler Gaffleone, of course, for the Greens, who are on their way. The Greens have got three horses in on Friday. Guns and Graces is going to be a price for Chad Brown and CHP. Is that Coffee Pot or is that, no? That's, is that one, is that a, who is that? Is that a China horse? No. White, black capped, CHP. I'm not sure, actually.
Well, that's not China Horse Club.
No, they're operating under CHC.
Yeah, they have different silks with the stars on them.
Right. So Joel Rosario, back aboard out of the Devona Dale. Julia Shining is mentioned, and Saez for Todd and Stone Street. They're homebred, double homebred. Carlin out of Dreaming of Julia. Punch Bowl, Uncle Mo, Philly, the West homebred, with Flavian Pratt, who rode her in her maiden breaker at Oaklawn, and Defining Purpose for McPeak out of the Honeybee, and Effortlessly Elegant for Norm Cassie, who has been just deadly this winter, the first third of the year. He's been killing it. 16 for 53 coming into the spring action at Keeneland. Terrific card to kick things off, highlighted by the Grade 1 Ashland Friday. There it is.
Yep.
Sid, we'll be...
We'll talk next week.
We'll talk
listen,
next week.
Best of luck on your travels. Say hi to Tina. And thanks for the exposure for Joe's gym. I appreciate it as always. And we'll talk later, bro.
You got it. Sid Fernando, everybody. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus. Brought to you by Hill and Dale and, of course, Work Thoroughbred Consultants. Let's take our only break of the morning. When we come back, Maury Wolf is going to join us. And, of course, we actually got quite a bit of the topic of the week, CAW play. We got quite a bit of that in with Dick Powell to start the morning, and we also touched on rebates. But Maury will bring us back and talk about everything that he... saw happening when it came to the groups and what kind of deleterious effect they could have and seemingly are having. There's also some things working internally, you know, the groups essentially, you know, cannibalizing each other too. That part hasn't been, you know, fully fleshed out. But frankly, I mean, with the kind of percentage that they've carved out, I mean, obviously they're you know, eating each other. To an extent, and there's one group in particular right now, one of the elite teams, with the mysteriously monikered Dr. Nick, who's really taking a toll on some of the other groups. So we'll let Maury walk you down this path and provide the kind of insight that only he can. At the races, we're live at Keeneland. A little bit more about, while the music plays, a little bit more about that card on Friday. The Lafayette, the first stake, the 7/8, and got a couple of stake types. Lugan Knight, your Jerome winner, comes here and looks like he's going to focus on, you know, the intermediate sprint distance for now. From Michael W. McCarthy, DG Stables, the Golden Sense homebred. Hijazi turns up here for Baffert and Amirzadan. And got swamped in the San Felipe by Practical Move, Go Rocket Ride, and Skinner, who will be assigned stalls later today at Santa Anita for the Derby. So nice pairing there. Marcassi offers Jack Oxley's Determinedly, who's okay. Brad Cox mentioned that Corona Bolt, who was the Sugar Bowl, right? Won the Sugar Bowl early in the meet. Fairly early in the meet at Fairgrounds. Freezing Point, Joe Ledgerwich out of the Battaglia. Hurricane J for AMO Racing, who we discussed yesterday with Graham. Paulo Lobo trains this one. Smoking Joe Talamo aboard. And how about Gulfport for Steve Asmussen, who's never been worse than third. But that was as a two-year-old. He makes his three-year-old debut in here. Nice addition. A seven-pack in the Lafayette. A Baker's half dozen. The Transylvania, too. I wonder if the girls from the basketball team are going to present the trophy. Back after this, Maury Wolfe.